I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause the earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planets temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas? We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
Welcome to KWMR Post Carbon Radio, and our show today is on confronting the California drought, water policy, and communities with Adam Scow and Javen Briggs. Adam Scow is California Director for Food and Water Watch. He is responsible for developing strategy for local, state, and national campaigns. He currently serves on the planning committee for the annual California Water Policy Conference sponsored by Public Officials for Water and Environment Reform. Previously, Adam researched California irrigation subsidies and water transfers in Washington, D.C. He holds a degree in political science from UC Berkeley. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. We also have on the phone Javen Briggs, who is a mother, educator, and experienced community organizer, who has recently joined Movement Rights. She currently splits her time in San Joaquin Valley of California, where her own residential well has run dry, and Los Angeles. She became involved in rights-based organizing while leading a Pennsylvania community group in leveraging their local community bill of rights ordinance to successfully resist a natural pipeline threat. Javen brings many years of experience leading community groups and nonprofits nationwide, primarily in the areas of environmental and education issues. A native of California, she's pleased to continue working with communities back home. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Javen.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. I think since Adam can only be with us in the first half hour, we'll focus on the work that you're doing at Food and Water Watch, and you probably have a pretty good bird's-eye view of what's going on with California water policy, being on the planning committee of the conference, the annual conference. Right, Adam?
Yeah. Sure do.
Okay. Maybe we'll start out with this year's conference. Can you tell us a little bit about it? It contains many perspectives. I know it's a huge subject.
Oh, yeah. Well, the conference is for mostly public officials and on the water boards around the state. And there's discussions of problems and ideas for reform. But that's one of the problems with California water is that there's a bunch of conferences on the subject, but not much. Things are very slow to change because of the way water is divided and allocated, where it's very much controlled by powerful interests who have enormous influence.
Adam, this is Bing's co-host, Karin Nahus. I'm just wondering if you're on a speakerphone?
Oh, no, but let me try to adjust.
Thanks. We want to hear you loud and clear.
Any better? Is this any better?
That's a lot better. Thank you.
Okay, sorry about that.
Great. So you were saying that there are a lot of water conferences and a lot of policy discussion, but that things change slowly, huh?
Yeah, things are changing very slowly in California, and one of the things we're calling for is some big reforms with respect to the way the state allocates water rights. The water right is basically a permit to use a certain amount of water. The fundamental problem is that the state has over-allocated all of the water rights in the last 50, 60 years, so demand is much greater than supply, and that's becoming more and more true with a more erratic precipitation patterns, less snow, and longer droughts. So this problem is not going to get solved until we balance demand with supply. And it's going to be a hard process, which will probably result in retiring some agricultural land that, frankly, we've never really had the water to support. It's masked in the wet years, but in the dry years, the truth really hits home about this imbalance. So that's something we've been calling attention to this year.
So how were those tough questions handled, or were they broached? Your conference was in March, right?
Yeah, the conference is not, the conference is for interested parties and water officials at the local level. These decisions are mostly made at the statewide level. The two agencies, the two branches of government, is the governor's office, Governor Brown himself, and the State Water Board, which is a body of five appointed officials that make decisions about the way state's water is allocated. And this is really where the heart of the problem is and where the bulk of the reform is needed.
Well, speaking of reform, probably we've covered the drought in a number of aspects on this show over the last year, including we had Stephanie Castle on, who did a pretty important piece of research, her group at UC Irvine, showing that there's been a great depletion of groundwater and that really we don't sort of know where the bottom of the barrel is on that. So it's a little unnerving. But of course, California has just passed this landmark groundwater management law, and it has good points and bad points. And one of the things we know is that it's phased in over the course of some 27 years. Do you want to talk about, are you in a position to talk about some of the main highlights of what that law was and how it relates to the current crisis?
Well, the current crisis is that we've overplanted in many parts of the Central Valley, in particular, and other parts of Southern California. And as we've had less rainfall and less river water to allocate, to pump south, those farmers have made up for that loss by overpumping the groundwater. And this is a big problem in the San Joaquin Valley where the ground is sinking every year. In some places, it's sunk as much as 30 feet over the last couple decades. We know one agricultural district, the biggest agricultural district in California, the Westlands Water District, which is down the I-5 on that hot and dry west side of the valley. They are on track to pump over 1 million acre-feet of groundwater in just the past 2 years. A million acre-feet of water is more water than Los Angeles, San Diego, and San Francisco combined use in a single year. And much of this is to support almonds, pistachios, most of which are going to be exported overseas. So this is a prime example of groundwater overpumping. This is also a problem in Salinas Valley, where it's estimated the aquifer, the Salinas Valley underground aquifer is being overpumped by 200 to 300,000 acre feet per year. So basically, if we continue, we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot. And the only people who can really put a stop to this, it doesn't seem like the farmers themselves are going to do it because of the amount of money they're making off some of these crops, is that we need government to take action to protect our water. In a sense, not just for everybody in California, but so agriculture can sustain itself over the next few years.
You know,
the groundwater law that passed, sorry, this is finally getting to your question.
Thank you.
It was actually quite weak and is mostly going to be insignificant. We've been trying to have groundwater law in California for a long time. regulation, rather. The laws are already in the books. In the state constitution, all the water in California belongs to the people of California and needs to be managed for the benefit of all Californians, a public trust resource. However, the State Water Board has made a distinction that does not exist in the Constitution between surface water and groundwater. And this is the heart of the problem. It's led to all sorts of depletion, and in effect, groundwater is private property, especially in many of these agricultural regions. Some cities have had adjudication where they've gone to court, figured things out, and have a management plan. But the big heart of the problem in the Central Valley, it's pretty much private property. You got it, you pump it. So the groundwater plan, the law that passed last year, basically tells some of these agencies, local agencies, that are the source of the problem, dominated by big ag, to please come up with a plan for a few years about how you're going to manage the groundwater. And maybe 5-10 years, we'll take a look and review and see what you've done. It's pretty pathetic, and it's inadequate to dealing with the crisis.
So who's trying to do something better? What's the leading edge on groundwater if it's not, you know, the recent legislation? If that's too slowpoke and too weak, who is working on it, and what should we be doing?
This comes back to the State Water Board, which has constitutional power to manage, protect, regulate groundwater to ensure it's not abused and overpumped. And it's really a political question, and they are only going to take action when the governor prods them to do so. The reality is that water flows uphill towards money. Some of these interests on the west side are the most powerful corporate agribusinesses in the nation. They get tons of money. The most politicians in California, at the state and federal level, we've seen very cozy relationships with both Senator Feinstein and Governor Brown, in particular on the west side interest, the Westlands Water District. And down in Kern County, we have Stuart Resnick, owner of Paramount Farms. He is perhaps the most powerful single ag interest in the state of California, a Beverly Hills billionaire, the largest grower shipper of pistachios, almonds, probably pomegranates as well. He owns Palm Wonderful, and now Halo's Mandarins in California. This man has enormous power over the way water is distributed and controlled. In fact, he even took control of a public underground aquifer known as the Kern County Water Bank. It was built and paid for with state taxpayer dollars as a way to hold water during droughts to provide water for the area, which is a good idea. It's better to store water in the ground. However, in a scandal that borders on corruption, the State Department of Water Resources has allowed Resnick to take a controlling interest in managing the Kern County Water Bank. This is now in litigation filed by the California Water Impact Network, a great organization we work very closely with. And hopefully that's going to be reversed. But this highlights the fact that groundwater has become de facto private property. The State Water Board, the governor, have to step up. There's no need to wait for another law to pass. They have the power to do it now. It's just a matter of political will and political pressure that we need to be placing on them and all of our elected officials, frankly.
Well, tell us a little bit about Brown's pet project, the Twin Tunnels. I know you at Food and Water Watch are advocating against it, of course.
Yeah, the governor has been proposing to build these massive twin tunnels to divert the Sacramento River. Now, the Sacramento River is about 80% of the freshwater flow going into the San Francisco Bay Delta estuary. Big Ag has long had their eyes on the Sacramento River and wanting to divert it directly. Currently, they pump from the south end of the Delta near Tracy by the 580 overpass. Their plan is to take the Sacramento River directly to those massive pumps. They tried to do this in the early 80s when we had Governor Jerry Brown I. The proposal was then known as the Peripheral Canal. It was an above-ground canal to take water from the Sacramento to the pump. Now the plan has been revived, as two massive underground tunnels called the Twin Tunnels. They've got a little more crafty in their public relations. the official name of the project is both the Bay Delta Conservation Plan, quite Orwellian, but now also known as the California Water Fix. And this project is intended to maintain high levels of water exports away from the Bay Delta to the massive growers down on the west side of the valley, the same growers I was just talking about. So we oppose this project. It would be terrible for the environment of the San Francisco Bay Delta Estuary. It's a terrible deal for taxpayers and water ratepayers, especially those in Southern California and in San Jose, who would subsidize the project, effectively subsidizing more water for corporate agribusiness. And that would come at the expense of the need to invest in fixing all the pipes in their areas. We have old pipes in our urban areas that are leaking at least 10, 12%. We're losing a lot of water. We need to replace those pipes much more rapidly in all of our urban areas. And it's going to cost quite a bit of money. It's been estimated that it'll cost $50 to $100 billion in California replacing all those pipes. And we have to do that. We have no choice. So therefore, we don't have any money to waste on these tunnels, which they have been estimated to cost as much as $60 billion. So it's an unfair California water scam that needs to be stopped.
So what's interesting to me about that, hearing it put in those terms, is that either we're going to do a big dig of this 35-mile-long twin tunnel project, or we need to go underground where there's already sort of tunnels and right away for the pipes, right? It seems like it would be an easier project to replace existing underground pipes than to dig through 35 miles of soil.
Absolutely, and it's a necessity. We have no choice. These are the pipes that bring us our water and provide our sewer on a day-to-day level. They are the foundation of our economy, our environment, and our health. And back about 100 years ago, when a lot of these pipes were first constructed, we had the federal government as a greater partner in financing it. Water infrastructure is quite heavy. It's quite expensive. It's our opinion that fixing it, upgrading it, is both a local, a state, and a federal responsibility. Now, we know the feds are not in great shape right now and have been absent in helping local governments ever since the 80s. They've pulled out as a partner, and that's something that has to change. This is especially true for smaller towns that don't have the big rate bases and tax bases, say like San Francisco or L.A., which can afford to do a lot of this on their own because they're such a big city, wealthy city. So that's something we're calling for right away. Yes, well, let's invest in fixing the infrastructure we must have, not waste money on infrastructure for special interests. That's what it comes down to.
I'd like to remind our listeners, we're talking to Adam Scowl, California Director for Food and Water Watch, and Jevon Briggs with Movement Rights. Jevon, do you want to weigh in on this?
I think he's doing a fantastic job of describing how our political systems really are so bureaucratically hands-tied with regard to allocating water fairly. And you have the decisions about water allocation being made at multiple levels. But I think from a movement's rights perspective, we're really looking at it in terms of the question of who should have the right to decide how these limited supply resources are allocated when there are communities that are being that are going without, with wells going dry across the Central Valley, and the politicians and the the entire system is failing to address this, what can communities do?
And this is Karin Nyhus weighing in. So what has Movement Rights found? I know you've been doing work around what's called the rights of nature and working with communities all over the state and elsewhere to bring local ordinances around the use of natural resources. How is that model evolving, and how does it apply to this situation?
Well, the model is evolving nationwide here. We have over 160 communities that have passed ordinances to stake a claim for self-government. And so the real question is, in rights-based organizing, is who gets to decide, our communities, the corporations, the state officials, about issues of local importance like fracking or water use, and empowering communities to write new laws, to assert their right, to be a part of that decision-making process when they've been so disenfranchised and are suffering the effects in terms of their health, safety, and welfare.
And then if it's groundwater we're talking about, say a community passes an ordinance and says you can only pump so much and you can't take more than your fair share within this community, I mean, it seems like there are some difficult issues, both that the aquifer may not overlap with the local community, and also how do you enforce that? What's the thinking around that from the community rights-based perspective?
So in terms of enforcing rights-based ordinances, I began rights-based work in Pennsylvania in 2013. I lived in a small central Pennsylvania town that's mostly home to, it's mostly known for being home to Penn State, which, by the way, is not a public institution. At the time, Penn State had made plans to renovate their campus energy supply system, and I'm stating all of this by way as an example. And as part of renovating their energy supply system, they intended to construct a major natural gas pipeline that was similar in magnitude to that at the accident sites like Bellingham, Washington, or San Bruno, or in southern Ohio. But these plans were made behind closed doors, like a lot of our current water policies, both at the local and state level here in California. And it involved a lot of glad handing between Penn State and Columbia Gas and local officials. Residents there only discovered it by chance. And when we realized that the intended pipeline was to be constructed within 40 feet of our homes, schools, churches, businesses, the entire community rallied. So like other communities facing corporate harm, we initially looked for help within the regulatory and political system, but we quickly discovered that they wouldn't save us, and we didn't have time for the bureaucratic process. However, we had one more tool. A couple of years prior, a 70% majority of Boro residents voted in a community bill of rights that was drafted with the assistance from the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And our community charter banned unsustainable infrastructure like the Penn State Pipeline on the basis that it violated our right to clean air, clean water, a sustainable future, and threatened the community's health, safety, and welfare. So the bill also established local democratic decision-making on issues of energy infrastructure. So the battle became quite heated. Columbia Gas threatened to sue the borough if they didn't issue the construction permit. Residents planned to intervene in the lawsuit using the Community Bill of Rights as legal leverage with the help of CELDEF. It really wasn't clear how our particular ordinance would fare in court, but the community was determined to protect our rights regardless. So we made public statements about our intent for civil disobedience if the construction were to begin. In the end, Penn State and Columbia Gas decided not to build the pipeline in our community's streets and backyards, as they couldn't afford the PR trouble. Remember back in 2013, Penn State was just coming off of the Jerry Sandusky scandal.
Yeah.
But there's a similar arc to the story here in California. Counties continue to issue record numbers of well drilling permits for agribusiness, while residential wells are increasingly going dry. Our community's groundwater security is being funneled into profits for just a handful of corporations. And residents here are beginning to call them on it. And as with the Penn State pipeline issue, some people are realizing that the regulatory and political systems offer no realistic solution.
Adam, I'd like to bring you back in the conversation. I know you're working also with communities like in Stockton, I think, and McLeod. Could you tell us about those campaigns?
Sure. Well, we help communities tackle a variety of projects. that relate to protecting their water. Oftentimes, they're fighting a proposal to privatize their water system. This is especially true at smaller towns, where in McLeod we had Nestle at one point proposed the largest water bottling facility in the nation. Now, they've backed down for now and instead opted to cut a deal with the mayor of Sacramento to bottle tap water. As it turns out, 30% of bottled water is tap water, and Nestle's tap water brand Pure Life, was outperforming its spring water brand known as Arrowhead. So they stopped fighting us and cut a deal there. However, it's come to light that they are overpumping groundwater in Southern California near Palm Springs and the San Bernardino Mountains, and this is adding up. It's not a whole heck of a lot of water in a single year, but it adds up little by little over time. Again, highlighting an abuse that groundwater is essentially private property. The campaigns right now, we've been spending a lot of time with communities battling fracking proposals and looking to pass local fracking bans. Last year, we helped the folks in San Benito County, home to Pinnacles National Park, pass a measure, a local initiative to ban fracking. It passed with 60% of the vote, despite being outspent nearly 10 to 1. The community raised about $100,000. This is a very small county, home to just two small towns, Hollister and San Juan Bautista. So the oil company spent over $2 million and beat them with 60% of the vote.
Wow.
This is very winnable when we have good coalitions at the grassroots level, people power. That's really what it takes to overcome corporate power. And it can be done. It just takes dedication and strong local leadership. So we're working with communities all around the state. Butte County, up in Chico, is looking to pass a fracking ban next year. Monterey County is in the process of looking to pass a fracking ban. Santa Barbara County, the city of Los Angeles, is looking to ban pretty much all oil development within their city limits. It's very exciting. So this is, I think, really the front lines in the battle to get us away from oil, away from fossil fuels, and towards renewables. We're really going to need to stop oil extraction. It's not good enough to just do renewables and allow oil companies to keep pumping and fracking the state. We really have to put a stop to that.
Yeah, so we have to both stop the bad and start the new. Both of you are bringing us actually very hopeful stories about the power of communities, and I think that's very important for our listeners, because sometimes we think that between big government and big corporations, that they're glad-handing, as you said, Javen, and that they have all the power and we don't. But both of you have just given examples of where communities, as you said, Adam, with good leadership, and as you said, Javen, with sort of the threat of disruption, are not only passing these ordinances, but really putting community power behind them. Adam, I know we're going to have to let you go, but I just want to give you a chance before you do to, if somebody's in a community and they want to hear more about these stories, where can they go online to sort of learn about the details of how one of these campaigns was carried out, and what lessons have been learned, and how they might get started in their own community, and how can they contact you?
Yeah, absolutely. They should go to our website. It's foodandwaterwash.org, all spelled out, foodandwaterwash.org. And you can find our California page. It's /California. You can see about some of our work, how to get in touch with us. We love working with folks to pass proactive measures. That's really what it's going to take to overturn, not just to overturn, but to change things at the statewide and national level. We need more local communities. We need a local movement, and that will change the tide little by little. But that's what it's going to take. So we're thankful to get to work with communities, and it's something we love to do.
I want to thank you, Adam, for joining us on Post Carbon Radio and taking this time out of your busy schedule.
Okay. Well, thank you both for having me. Have a good day. Yeah,
thank you. Now we need to take a station break. You're listening to KWMR, 90.5 FM Point Reyes, 92.3 FM San Geronimo Valley, 89.9 FM Bolina, streaming live at kwmr.org. And now back to Post Carbon Radio. And, Jevin, I wonder if you could tell us, you're living in the San Joaquin Valley, and tell us where and what you're seeing there. I know you said that your own residential well went dry.
Right. I am currently splitting my time between Los Angeles and Madera, which is an agricultural town just north of Fresno. And as you just mentioned, my own residential well just went dry last month. My well sits about 30 feet from a large agricultural well, and they both access water from the same underground aquifer. But since my well was shallower than the agricultural well, mine went dry, while theirs continues to flood irrigate the neighboring corporate grape and almond crops day and night. Their well will probably eventually go dry as well, but the larger farms can afford to just drill new ones. So you see, these large corporate farms are relying, as Adam mentioned, more and more on groundwater for their crops because the surface water is increasingly scarce. Basically, if you own a well, you can drain as much groundwater as you want. But the problem is everybody is sipping from the same cup, and without rain, we're not going to get any refills. So right now, my family survives off of water from a large tank installed beside my house. We have to be very careful about our water use because we only have water when the tank is filled. But we're the lucky ones. It's become relatively common for people in the Central Valley to have to resort to bottled water or even hauling gallons home in the back of their trucks just to have it for basic cooking and hygiene. Many families here can't afford the $6,000 to install a storage tank like mine, or the $13,000 to $25,000 price tag to drill a new well. But even for residents with means, the wait lists for residential well drilling here are 6 to 12 months long, in part because of competition from corporate farms who bring in the higher paying jobs.
Yeah, the drillers, they have, you know, 3-inch thick binders with standing orders, right?
Right. The wait can be longer than a year in some cases, depending on, there's, you know, backroom deals, people paying companies to get up higher on the wait list and things like that happening. So the people with money will get the wells faster. But the cost of well drilling really hasn't slowed these corporate farms from drawing more and more community groundwater or profiteering from it. The agriculture wells can cost $500,000 or more, but even at that rate, the cash crops like almonds are still really moneymakers. There's a well drilling boom here. Mm-hmm. The CEO of Lyons Magnus, which grows and processes agricultural products, he recently shelled out $1 million to purchase his own well drilling rig to supply his own crops.
Wow.
But we have other agribusinesses in the valley that are also making money hand over fist through groundwater mining. There was a recent analysis by KQED that said over 60 billion gallons of Central Valley groundwater may be sold for profit this year. So the people in the communities across the Central Valley, they're beginning to fill up county meetings and write letters to the editor and form community activist groups to claim their inherent right to this water. But despite the so-called protective environmental policies we have in place and the political uproar, our community's right to water continues to be denied by corporate taking and abuse.
So I have a question. So go ahead.
It's not really just about the corporate farms, though. It's the fact that what they're doing is actually legal.
Right. Well, I'm wondering, with wells running dry and people losing their water supply in your area, I imagine that some people who can't, as you said, afford to install a tank and maybe can't afford to buy bottled water, are people looking to secondary sources? Are there water quality problems? Are there health impacts on people using less than clean water?
I'm not aware of the immediate health impacts of it, I imagine. I mean, the water's very scarce. You end up, every drop is precious. You use your gray water from doing your dishes to water plants and stuff. I've seen hoses run between houses where neighbors are funneling water, you know, between each other. there's a lot of creativity happening here in mm-hmm. order to just keep a minimal access to water for hygiene and cooking.
Now, in your article, you wrote a recent article on the Movement Rights website, and you talked about something called the regulatory hamster wheel. What is that?
Right. It's the regulatory hamster wheel. You can think of it as a box of sort. As a citizen, you're faced with the problem of corporate harm coming into your community. And first you go to the water board, or you go to the city council meetings, or you go to all of these political or regulatory agencies, and they all say, well, we have our hands tied, or it's going to take time, or that change has to happen at the state level, and it's going to take years. And still, you're standing there with no water. So, in that article I wrote, which is going to be published on opendemocracy.net next week, a more detailed version of it, I'm basically asking the question, who should decide our community's water future? And I lay out how the Central Valley groundwater resources are being taken from people and our natural communities by corporations involved in unsustainable farming practices to grow these cash crops that are largely for export, and how, despite community uproar throughout the valley, the regulatory and political systems have been ineffective at addressing the problem. So I think, as was mentioned before, California recently passed legislation, as an example, mandating local agencies to create a groundwater management plan. Mm-hmm. But here's the crux. Counties are allowed 25 years to draft and implement their sustainability plan.
Right.
And we simply don't have that much time. In Stanislaus County recently, they recently passed their mandated sustainability plan, but it was drafted by an advisory committee dominated by agriculture interests. And so, not surprisingly, their plan requires some new monitoring of groundwater levels, but it completely fails to address the rampant issuance of new well permits for corporate crops or groundwater pumping by agribusiness. And so we have elected officials in several counties in the Central Valley on record basically stating that their hands are tied. They have no ability to help families whose wells have gone dry, but they also say they can't deny well drilling permits to corporate farmers.
They can't deny them, or they won't?
They say they can't. They legally cannot deny the well drilling permit to the corporate farmers.
But the notion of a permit is that there are some conditions under which it will be granted and some that there won't, right?
Well, if it's on private property, they have the ability to get their well drilling permit if they can afford to drill the well. So we have these weak policies failing to provide groundwater security for our communities. So some are still, this is the regulatory hamster wheel, some are still hoping to find remedy in the legal arena. Last year, two environmental groups filed lawsuits. The first lawsuit intended to require several large-scale farmers in 9 Central Valley municipalities to adhere to the California Environmental Quality Act requirements before drilling any new wells, right?
Yeah.
But the case settled out of court when most of the farmers agreed to pay only $190,000 toward groundwater studies. Effectively, the community's right to water got legally bargained away to agribusiness. Now, there's a second lawsuit brought by the same environmental groups against Stanislaus County's Department of Environmental Resources. It aims to require environmental reviews before any new ag wells are permitted. But even if this case wins at the October trial, the ineffectual regulatory hamster wheel persists, because the framework of permitting effectively provides an official sanctioning to water pilfering for profit. So the problem is that California's current development-centric policies view nature as an external and like an eternal endowment. Our groundwater resources are being increasingly privatized by corporations for unsustainable economic growth, rather than being managed as a limited supply community resource that is interconnected with human and natural communities and their health and their future. This misconception has brought us increased economic disparity and we're at the brink of environmental bankruptcy.
I like this paragraph you have in your article here. I'm going to read it. It says, but American policy and law protects the rights of property more rigorously than the rights of people and nature. As global water leader Maud Barlow, she wrote a book called Blue Gold, by the way, so eloquently stated, the problem in California, as in so many parts of the world, is that water is seen as a resource for our convenience and profit and not as the essential element of an ecosystem that gives us life. As well, water is more and more seen as a form of private property, and powerful forces increasingly resist any attempt by governments to limit their abuse of water. And we had a program just recently stating that the fish are kind of caught in a crossfire here with taking water from the Delta, and we're seeing extinctions of several species, I believe.
Yes, we are. In fact, here near my house, I've seen coyotes hunting in the grapevines in broad daylight because there's a lack of surface water. The coyotes are now making their dens this year in the grapevines, and their typical prey, the rats and the smaller, the bunnies and the smaller critters around here, are in an apparent population decline. So they are now coming closer to houses and eating dog food off people's porches and hunting in broad daylight. So we're seeing effects in our entire ecosystem here.
Including the humans as part of that ecosystem.
Right.
Are people leaving? Are there places where people are running out of water and leaving?
Not yet. Right now in the Central Valley, especially for the grapes and the almonds, which I, what I know best because I live next to it, harvest season is ongoing and will continue for the next couple of weeks. So we've actually seen an influx of population of farm workers here.
So we've done a lot of talking about what the problems are, and I'd like to get back to solutions. So what do you think is the leading edge in community-based and rights-based solutions regarding groundwater in California?
Well, we're going to have to work at the grassroots level to shift our culture and law to truly protect people and the environment. It's the civil rights struggle of our time, and it's already happening across the nation. As I mentioned earlier, over 160 communities across the U.S. have already passed local self-governance ordinances, and the momentum is growing. Last year, for instance, Movement Rights helped Mendocino County pass a Bill of Rights to protect their local water by banning fracking. But changing the rules is going to really require more than tinkering at the margins of the current legal, political, and corporate-led economic system. We will need systemic change, starting from the grassroots. It begins with neighbors coming together to change their community.
And where, if listeners want to follow your work and maybe get involved with it, where would they go on Movement Rights to find out more about how to start something in their very own community?
How to start something. They can learn more about rights-based organizing and access toolkits as well as downloadable resources on our website, movementrights.org. And they can find my article there on the blog attached to the website.
Okay, great. And, you know, if you could wave a magic wand and say, totally transform the sort of conceptual basis and the reality of law around water in California. I know I'm springing this on you unprepared, but how would that look? How would that be different from the way the law is now?
Well, it would elevate the rights. We need laws and culture that elevate the rights of people and communities and their natural ecosystems. Ahead of the so-called corporate rights that are taking precedence in our legal and political systems at this point. So we really are talking about an entire shift in cultural mindset and also law, which are completely integrated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to wrap up this segment and want to thank you, Javen, for joining us on Points Carbon Radio and telling us about your work at Movement Rights. Can you give us a website?
Sure. Our website is movementrights.org. And again, people can access more information about rights-based organizing and toolkits, as well as we have a lot of downloadable resources. And they are welcome to get in touch with me at Javen, J-A-V-A-N, at movementrights.org. If they have any questions or would like to know how to get started in their own community.
Great. Thank you so much, Javen, for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay.